11, I think we're going to go ahead and get started. Welcome back to those of you that have been here before, and good to see those of you that are new. So for those of you that haven't been here before, my name is Marin. I'm a general internist. I work as a hospitalist in Boston at a small public hospital that's affiliated with Harvard Medical School. I teach residents and medical students, and I also work in the hospital trying to make things work better. And I'm not a theologian, and I'm not a policy analyst, but you're engaging both of those questions today, and I'm engaging them like you are, as a curious person trying to figure this stuff out and what it means for me in my practice and for us as people of the faith community. And I'll try to speak up, sorry. I see the hands behind the ears. So this is day three, and I wanted to just, today the theme of our conversation is the Affordable Care Act, sometimes pejoratively known as Obamacare, and I titled my session, God's Position on the Affordable Care Act, or alternatively, What Would Jesus Do? And I did that intentionally being presumptive. Of course, I have no idea what God's position on the Affordable Care Act is actually, but I wanted to engage that question. So just to get everybody onto the same page, for those of you that weren't here before, here's a reprise from day one. So on our first day, we were just exploring the big picture perspective that the need for healing is an infinite, universal part of the human condition. It is what we're calling in the Bible study thirstiness. Okay? It is what it means to be a human being. And our attempts to meet that need through the healthcare system are inevitably finite and particular, not infinite and universal. So inevitably, the healthcare system is unable to meet the needs that people come to the healthcare system with. So we were exploring that tension sort of theoretically on day one. And I also just gave a brief sort of history of the relationship between this shared mission that the church and the healthcare system have had throughout history, and recognized that in the last 50 years in the United States, we've actually moved into an unusual departure from what used to be a kind of shared mission. Hospitals in their early days were extensions of the church, of the organized church. But with science and the evolution of medical technology and the complexity of bureaucratic relationships that control our current healthcare practice, the church has been left behind in many ways. And the medical profession, the healthcare industry, is out on its own trying to deal with these problems. Day two, I introduced this construct here that healing is the restoration of right relationships. We talked about relationships within the body, cells, organs, biochemical processes, physiological processes, but not only physiological and physical processes, but also relationships between mind and body, questions of meaning that people ask and identity when they become ill or when they become injured. Not only relationships within the body and between the mind and the body, but relationships between people, relationships with people and the environment, relationships with people and the divine. So if you think about healing very broadly, healing is a relational construct. And yesterday, we thought specifically about the way in which health is created by relationships that are social relationships. And so we looked at wealth and poverty and the gradient between wealth and poor that manifests as life expectancy and health outcomes of all varieties. And this framing comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. They have done some work in thinking about how can we, as a people concerned about health, talk about the social determinants of health in such a way that everybody, Democrat and Republican, feels like it's a shared agenda. So this is their language. They say, this is an advocacy message basically, stop thinking about health as something we get at the doctor's office, but instead as something that starts in our families, our schools, our workplaces, playgrounds and parks, in the air we breathe and the water we drink. The more you see the problem of health this way, the more opportunities you have to improve.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Was that, did you say that came from a, that statement is from somebody, or is
yes,
that,
so
is that
the,
a verbatim statement?
That is their statement. So the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation did focus groups and asked people to make pictures and collages trying to expose how do Democrats and Republicans think differently about this issue of public health and the social determinants of health. And they found that Democrats and Republicans use different dominant metaphors for thinking about these things. Mm-hmm. And this was their attempt to construct a statement that would actually tap into some of the metaphors that are shared that actually feels acceptable to both sides of the political spectrum.
And I just found it interesting that there is an absence of the church. We talk about family, school, workplace, playgrounds, parks.
Yeah.
With the church.
That's very interesting. Yeah, and I think that's, so we. I have been coming at this largely from the perspective of sort of a critique of the U.S. healthcare system, but we can also think about it as a critique of the church. Where's the church? Is the church not important in health and wellness for individuals and communities? Isn't that what the church is about? But in public discourse, it falls off. Any other thoughts or questions about where we've been, day one and day two? Okay. So today, we're going to start, since I've presumptively called this, What Would Jesus Do? We're going to start by looking at some healing stories of Jesus from the Gospel of Mark and one from the Gospel of John. So I have 30 copies of these. Yeah, so I think I'm going to ask you if you pass these around.
Sorry, I can make more if you think it's helpful. We can just use
Bibles. We also can use Bibles. The Bibles are fine, too. What I want is for us to get into just groups of three or four, sort of cluster with the people around you, and I'm going to assign... I would like, you know, some groups to be talking about each one of these stories. And we're going to spend about 10 minutes in these small groups. And the question that I want you to struggle with is, so I would guess that for most of you, these are going to be familiar stories. You're not going to be reading them for the first time. And you're only going to be focusing in your small group on one of these stories. So we'll just, if you can sort of identify yourself in a group, move your chairs so it's clear that you're a group, and then we can just go 1, 2, 3, 4, and pick the different stories. So, so once you get yourself configured as groups, I'll give you instructions, okay? John 9. Alright? And the group in the back there, you're Mark 5, 21. This group right here, you're Mark 2, 1 through 12. This group here, you're Mark 9. So you're back to John. And then this group back here is Mark 5. You back, and that is Mark 2. Right? And then your group right here, Mark 9. You guys are back to John. You're Mark 5. Mark 2 back there, Mark 9 over there, you're John, okay? So you can be Mark 5 up there, Mark 2, Mark 9, and you can be Mark, you can be back to John, okay? So now let me tell you what you're talking about, okay? So you each have one healing story of Jesus, and what I want you to not get distracted by how questions. How did Jesus do that? Why did she stop hemorrhaging? Don't worry about it, because that's very distracting. And in the time that Jesus was milling about on the earth, there were a lot of these people, miracle healers, walking around. And it wasn't distracting to the people of the time shouldn't be distracting to us. We have gotten a lot more sophisticated in answering how questions about how the body works. And this is not a conversation about how the healing actually happened. So don't let that bother you. I want you to engage the story and think about what do we learn about healing through these stories that still feels true to us today. What resonates for us about the experience of healing in these stories? So what resonates about the experience of being sick? What resonates about the experience of being healed? And what can we learn about God through Jesus and how Jesus responds in these stories? Okay? So 10 minutes, maybe one person can volunteer to read the story out loud and just think in sort of a positive frame. What's true here about being ill? What's true about healing? And what's true about God as manifested through the way Jesus behaves? All right? And then we'll debrief. What did you learn? What's true for us about the experience of being ill, about the experience of healing? What's true about God from these stories in relationship to illness and
healing? Yeah. We discussed, for me, and I think the group resonated that early on in the story, the disciples asked, oh, what's wrong? Who sinned? Was it him or his parents? And Jesus basically said, don't worry about that. Let's just heal the man. Let's move on. So it's not about trying to find fault, blame, or health problems as a moral judgment, but it's about healing. Let's make this man whole.
Absolutely. So this question of the relationship between sin and disease is a question that is prevalent throughout the Bible. It's rampant in our contemporary conversations about, you know, whose fault is it that you got sick? And you know, if you're a smoker, should your insurance premiums be higher? And it's absolutely, it's a very live question for us today, is this relationship between sin and disease. And in the Gospel of John's story that we looked at, he doesn't say exactly it doesn't matter. He says, it happened, right? You want to just read what he said?
Yeah. Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus answered, neither this man nor his parents sinned. He was born blind so that God's works might be revealed in him. So it's an opportunity. This man's predicament represents an opportunity to see a larger power.
Okay.
And the first sentence is, as Jesus walked along, he saw a man. So he noticed. Mm-hmm. So to the extent, I mean, this was not sort of somebody brought to him, but it was him noticing the predicament.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very interesting. So this is the only story of the four that we've looked at where the initiative comes from God.
Yeah.
The man doesn't ask for healing. His friends don't bring him to be healed. His father doesn't bring him to be healed. God just offers this healing, sitting on the side of the road, right? And he doesn't even know who Jesus is. At the end, when people ask him who healed him, he says, this man called Jesus. It's not a reward for his faithfulness. It just happens. So God's presence just kind of creates healing for this. Okay, there are lots of things here. I'm not sure we're able to take them all up, but so I'm just going to say God takes the initiative. God saw, God noticed, God cared. Yeah. Yes.
This might be not what we want to discuss, so in which case, just say that.
Yeah.
But it's about what we were just saying. We were talking about what House says, he was born blind so that God's works might be revealed in him. It just, it seems, the idea that this man would have gone his entire life so far blind just so that God's works might be revealed in him seems like kind of a bum rap. You know, if it had said, because this man was born blind, God's works might be revealed in him. Like, then that would be different. Then that would be more of the opportunity, it seems like. God, but anyway.
Yeah,
just the idea that
I think that's an interesting observation. I mean, who knows that God's works couldn't have been revealed in him many years ago, or weren't,
right.
Or hadn't been. And what's the relationship, actually, between losing his blindness and having God's works revealed in him? I'm not sure. But in this text, as in all the other texts, actually, the people who are ill actually get physically healed as well. So, you know, you could say, this man is blind, so God's works are revealed in him, and he stays blind. But he doesn't here. So there's also this way in which these stories, it's not as though it's just an ethereal, spiritual thing. There is attention to the actual physical experience that people are living, and it's materially changed in these stories, so that it's not just a spiritual healing that is being offered, it's actually a physical healing as well. Okay. Any other thoughts? We're just going to move quickly through these four stories because we're never going to get the Affordable Care Act if we don't do that.
The man has to participate.
Okay, in what way?
He has to go wash.
Uh-huh.
In a pool whose name is Scent, means scent, so it fits with that theme.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So when you, I think it's possible in the same way that in the Bible study we're thinking about thirst and living water as a metaphor, healing is also a metaphor, and you can read these stories metaphorically. So what does it mean to be healed in a pool that's called Scent? I don't know exactly, but it feels like a metaphor. So we're healed to go forth, to do something. There's some call. It's not just healing for healing's sake. It's healing for work in the world. We're sent out. I think it's fascinating.
Well, then there's the response of the community of questioning him about challenging him on how it happened, and then he has no evidence. Jesus is gone. There's no way to say. And he, you know, it's interesting.
Yeah. So there's that the deeply subjective experience of both illness and healing. He can't really speak to it. Doesn't really know what happened. All right, I mean, I think we could spend, you know, an hour on each one of these stories for sure, but let's just harvest a few more thoughts. Anybody else who was talking about the Gospel of John story?
Yeah. He doesn't have an identity before he gets healed. They're not sure who he is at the end of the passage when he's talking to all the people in the community, and then he establishes an identity and establishes a place in the community after he's healed.
Huh. Very interesting. So in the spirit of healing is the restoration of relationships, one of the things that's very common in these healing stories of Jesus is that to be diseased is to have no place in the community, to have no identity, to have no role to play, right? And that's absolutely true in our current experience of being ill. Susan Sontag, who wrote a book called Illness as Metaphor, talks about we travel, we're born with two passports, one that brings us into the kingdom of the well, and the other that brings us into the kingdom of the sick. And we prefer to travel through life using only the one passport. But in fact, we have to travel with both. And I think that in this story, he gets an identity, and actually people recognize him. He has a role to play, a place. So healing gives a role to play. Yes, understates it, but. Okay, let's move to the next story. I think it was Mark 5. Okay.
We talked to them about how motivated the people were. It's the story of the woman who touches Jesus' garment and the father who comes to Jesus because his daughter had died or thought she died. So they were highly motivated to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so healing starts with asking for healing. And that not only requires motivation, it also requires vulnerability. You have to actually, you have to name your need, or you can't get help. Okay? I mean, not in every story. The man in John didn't name his need at all, but sometimes that's a huge part of the experience of healing, is actually starting from a place of asking. Anybody else who was rude? Yeah.
Healing seems to begin with your decision to want to be healed, and then a further decision to search for a way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
The story doesn't say that the two people knew much about Jesus,
mm-hmm.
only perhaps that they had seen his miracles.
Absolutely.
So the search has a as a component.
Yeah. So it's not just asking, it's having a desire, searching for, and then asking, right? It's an active process. Anybody else who's reading the Mark 5 story?
They also had to have faith in their healer, so they couldn't just see that he had done miracles, they had to believe that he could help them personally.
Okay, so I think that's a very interesting point, and it's complicated, the role of faith and healing in these stories. So in the four stories that I gave you, faith plays a different role in each one of those stories. So in the John story, the man didn't have any faith. He comes to have faith after, he doesn't even know who Jesus is. He's just sitting there begging, what he does for a living, and Jesus walks by and heals him. So faith comes for him after the healing. Faith isn't even a part of his journey for healing. For the man who brings his boy with a seizure disorder of some variety or demon possession, however you want to think about it, he says, "Help my unbelief." Right? He doesn't have faith. He says, "Help me! I don't believe. I don't have any faith." Mm-hmm. And then so faith plays into this in complicated ways. But clearly it plays a role. You can say faith matters, but it matters in a difficult way. It's not as though healing is a reward for good faith and lack of healing is a punishment for the absence of faith. It's not quite that simple. Yeah.
Well, and that faith comes after the finite ability of the health profession to cure it or whatever. It was they had exhausted what was known about how to heal at that time. At least that was my impression.
Yes, the hemorrhaging woman had already been exhausted by physicians.
That was mine, yeah.
Yeah. So even here in this text, you can see there's a relationship. There are healers walking about that call themselves, at least in this text, physicians. And Jesus is offering something different in some way. Yeah.
The two healings in this seem to be done with such compassion.
Uh-huh. Say more about that.
This was a compassionate healer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's really striking if you read the whole Gospel of Mark just from beginning to end, that Jesus is besieged with people seeking healing. And he never turns anybody away. He never says, I'm too tired, it's 5 o'clock, it's Friday, you don't have the right insurance, or we can't do that. And he actually responds in real time, in the moment. He stops what he's doing. He attends to the need of the person right in front of him. And he's on his way to respond to Jairus' request, and this woman stops him, and he stops and responds. So it seems there. In the example of Jesus, we have this sort of unlimited capacity for compassion and mercy.
Seems to trump.
Yeah, it seems to trump whatever else is going on. Yeah.
And the way he responds is amazingly relational. Mm-hmm. That is, she is out without a husband or father in
and ill, both terrible taboos.
Mm.
And the first thing he says to her is daughter.
Mm.
And so that legitimates her very existence.
Mm.
It creates a very intimate relationship.
Mm. Yeah, that's beautiful. Sort of expanding on this construct of compassion, which seems so fundamental to the way that that God, in the form of Jesus, responds to human suffering with this deep compassion. And it's sort of implicit in what you were saying. So he's flagged by Jairus, this wealthy man. He's on his way to respond to Jairus' need when this outcast, this woman who is without any social standing, stops him, and he stops. So this compassion is actually delivered equally to people regardless of their social standing. Let's move on to the Mark 2 text.
Okay, we have Mark 2,
okay.
12, and it's the story of the paralytic that his family and friends brought him.
Mm-hmm.
They have the faith.
Mm-hmm. There you go, another version on the faith healings.
And the scribes, like their story in John, the scribes thought, because of his sin, maybe he deserved to be paralytic.
So two important points there. One is that his family and friends matter. We'll just say that, although it's more complicated than that. I mean, here, the initiative for healing actually comes from the family and or his friends, not from him at all. And then there's this sort of, the sin stuff comes up again. So it's different than the way it comes up in John. So this man comes to Jesus, paralyzed. His friends bring him, cut a hole in the roof, bring him down. And Jesus says, your sins are forgiven? You can imagine the paralyzed man saying, I didn't ask you to forgive my sins, right? What do you mean, my sins are forgiven? What do you make of that?
We talked about a couple of things up here, but one is that there was this absolute division between sort of bodily healing and whole person healing, and it was exactly the same divisions that we complain about in our system today. And we spent an unbelievable percentage of our dollars in our healthcare system to heal the physical body, and we completely missed the boat to heal the whole person, because it turns out it's a lot harder, just like Jesus said, to heal the whole person. So we're just going to keep throwing all our dollars into the physical body and miss the boat. The other thing that I was really struck with is that there was just a ton of bureaucracy and difficulty to try and get this man to Jesus then too. So we can quit like our pity party, because it's been going on for a very, very long time. So.
Yes. Okay, I love that. So the obstacles to healing.
And they even went to the extreme of making a hole in the roof to bring him down.
Yeah, I just have to send people down to the, to the insurance office and have them fill out paperwork. Because in Massachusetts, everybody actually has access to insurance, but it's fine cutting a hole in the roof. All right. Any other thoughts on that, Mark?
Well, one thing you need to take the leap of faith through all this stuff, and all the scribes are talking about this is wrong, blah, 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 blah. And Jesus talks to them first, and then he tells the man to get up and walk, and the man did it, and it worked. I would like to know what the scribe said later.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. So Jesus, as a healer, that work brought him into conflict with the authorities of his day. These were religious authorities. But healing is actually subversive and is dangerous. And Jesus got into trouble for doing that. Mm-hmm.
Can't you just hear the insurance companies going, was that doctor in the network?
Excellent. All right, so one last story that we haven't talked about. Any new thoughts that come from, I think it's the Mark 5, no, it's the story of the demon being cast out, the father bringing his son with the seizure disorder, or hard for me not to say that, the father bringing the son with fits and a demon to Jesus.
One of the comments I was making to group was that really in most of these stories, and of course Mark is a lot this way, but the healing is one sentence. Mm-hmm. It's not the whole story. The whole story is a whole lot of other stuff. But the healing per se is just sort of, it happens, and then we go on and talk about what happened before, what happened after, but healing is.
Yeah, that's very interesting. How does that connect with what you know about the actual experience of illness and healing? And
that is an interesting perspective. In my own personal life, I guess I would say there's a moment when I know I am going to be better.
Interesting.
You know, you go through the valley of the shadow of death, but then there's a moment when you say, oh, well, maybe I'm going to come out.
But if I was a better Bible scholar, I would know more about the words that are used in these stories. What I do know from doing a little bit of reading is that there are lots of different words for healing, and they appear differently in these different stories, but I'm not enough of a Bible scholar to be able to tease them out. But so I think part of what you're getting at is that there's that this process of healing actually is complicated. So some of it happens in a moment, but then, as you say, it's nested in some story that is longer. So maybe this process of healing, there are moments of quantum leaps of healing, but then there's also some other process which is slower and more social.
As we talked about, the person now becomes part of the community again. Mm-hmm. You know that there's going to be things that are going to happen afterwards, or they go to the pool, or there's something else that happens.
Yep, absolutely. I think in the story of the 10 lepers that come to Jesus for healing, mm-hmm. where he heals 10 and 9 go away and 1 comes back to say thank you, there are 2 different words for healing that are used, and the 9 get one kind of healing, and the 10th actually gets another kind. So that the gratitude is a part of a fuller kind of healing that is possible through God. All right, so this is just a teaser.
One other comment I want to make about this last passage, too, is the father in this, Jesus says, well, you just have to have faith.
Mm-hmm.
And the father says, well, I have faith, but help my unbelief.
Mm-hmm.
And the commentary here in the side says, can you believe and not believe at the same time? Is faith either or?
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is an important notion that maybe is healing either or.
Mm-hmm.
Are we whole? Or are we only working to become whole?
Mm-hmm.
A good picture, isn't it?
Very interesting. And I think there's oftentimes a distinction made between belief and faith. So belief is a cognitive thing.
Mm-hmm.
Faith is actually a lived, embodied thing. So cognitively, he said, help my unbelief. Mm-hmm. But in an embodied way, he brought his son to Jesus, which was an act of faith.
I think we shared in our story how much your mind has control over your body and your healing.
It's mm-hmm. one of the very important relationships that is a part of healing. Absolutely. All right, so with that as a frame, what we've learned about Jesus and through Jesus, what we've learned about God and God's perspective on healing, let's think about where we are in the United States right now. Okay. Okay, so I'm just going to flip through a few political cartoons. I'm not going to comment on them. Just look at them quietly, and then we'll talk about, so what's going on? What is the reaction that we have had? Because healthcare has been a front and center part of our public discourse for the last couple of years, right? So we'll just look at a few of these.
Ha 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 ha
So what's going on? What is all of this fear, vitriol, and tension? Where does it come from? And what are we worried about?
What I've found in talking with people who do not share my political view of the world, some people, is a visceral reaction to taking care of people who should take care of themselves. That independence is at the root of what it means to be human and American, and by golly, we need to reinforce that and not somehow substitute a bureaucracy, a program to do things for people that they really should do for themselves. And that's how I've interpreted the view from the other side.
Mm-hmm. It's fear of socialism, and it started under Roosevelt, actually. They tried, who was the woman that tried to pass more of this type of health care, and they were very much against it, because right from the get-go, we've been very anti-socialism, as much as they're anti-communism.
Mm-hmm. So there's a strong individualism part of what it means to be an American, so we're suspicious of the common, we're suspicious of government, we're suspicious of bureaucracy, some level. I think those are definitely manifested here. Other thoughts? Yeah.
Maybe fear of the unknown.
This does not have piano lessons today.
Many of the seniors with whom I've spoken have worried about how much it's going to cost them. They want to keep more money for them, and they don't want to look at the fact that they have Medicare, which is already socialized medicine. And it's money.
Yep. So people are nervous about having less control over how they spend their money. That's an important part of individual autonomy. It feels like we have the right. We earn this money. It's a conversation that we've been having in the consumerism conversation. It's our money. We've labored for it. We want to spend it the way we want to spend it. Don't tell me how I have to spend it.
I think there's also kind of a myth about the government, and when the government gets involved in something, it's going to be, you know, not going to work out, it's going to be bad. You know, you stand in long lines at the post office and you go to the Social Security office. So I think we have these images in our culture of government involvement that we're afraid of.
Yes.
Because they're sort of manifested in these.
It's kind of a reflex anti-government sort of orientation, especially, maybe, you know, this in this sacred encounter,
right,
where we come naked and small and vulnerable. And we need to trust the caring physician. We don't want government limiting our ability to trust.
Go ahead.
Well, and part of it is a lack of understanding that there's already a lot of interference in that relationship by the insurance companies. That it's much greater than that.
Yeah, the relationship doesn't look like this.
No.
Just, you know.
That's what I was going to say, is that just substitute it. Insurance company executive there.
Yeah.
It tells
them
the story.
Oh my gosh.
15 minutes.
Uh-oh, it's 15 minutes. Now we're in trouble. We're going to have to stop. This will be a really interesting conversation to continue, but we need to move on to talk a little bit about the... So I think that the trying to understand this reaction is critically important and helpful to think about in the context of the healing agenda of God that we've just been...
Lauren?
Yes?
Just highlight that the Thursday night forum is going to continue this specific set of questions, and so there'll be another chance to open up these conversations about what people are afraid of. what the relationship is between consumer choice and the healthcare debate and so forth. So
excellent.
Don't feel like there's no other chance to talk about it.
Okay. And obviously, this is still it's very live,
hot topic
for us as we move into the fall, right? So no matter how you feel about the Affordable Care Act, you know, is it actually a bridge that's taking us halfway to the other side or not? Here's another answer. Let's blow it up, and maybe the House will vote a 34th time to repeal. So where does this come from, the need to do the Affordable Care Act? So I'm going to argue that it is primarily a financial motivation. That's what got us to this place from the perspective of the policymakers that are that have drafted the Affordable Care Act. So if you look at our national healthcare expenditures per capita over the last 50 years, so I don't know how that happened. You can see that they have grown, and you know, here's Medicare and Medicaid, right? That's kind of where it started, public investment in our healthcare system. And you can see that it has just grown really exponentially, and it keeps growing. And this is dramatically out of sync with the way the rest of the world is operating. So here is a projection about our federal budget, and you can see that health is the largest driver of our federal government spending. So we have a huge problem related to how much money we spend on healthcare in this country. We can't afford to do it the way we've been doing it. And you can see that although we looked yesterday at some of our health outcomes, despite the fact that we do not have outstanding health outcomes, no matter what metric you use for it, we don't live longer, our infant mortality isn't lower, our days lost from work isn't lower. We're not getting good outcomes for what we're buying, but we're spending more than any other country in the rest of the world by an order of magnitude. And here's the U.S. on the black line there. This is a measure called the purchasing power parity. So this is what it feels like for a household in terms of how far their dollar goes and the relative amount of money that we have to spend to get the health care that we get in this country. So we're an outlier in the world. And despite how much money we spend, as I said, we don't get better outcomes and we don't have access for everybody. So still 16% of people are uninsured. Already, you can see that, 30% of people get their health care from the government, basically, Medicare and Medicaid. And then half of people in the United States get their health insurance through their employer. So if you're going to build on what we've got, this is what you have to work with in terms of improving access.
Yeah. Quick response to the question in 1960, how many people were employer-sponsored, covered? I mean, is that 49% a pretty new figure for the last generation or two?
I don't know the answer to that.
Roughly.
I don't know the answer to the question. It was. I'm sure there were more uninsured people in 1960. And fewer, this sector wasn't there.
Right.
So proportionately, that might have been about the same, but I don't know.
Because I think the illusion is frequently what it used to be that we were all covered by, and that's never been true.
It used to be this.
But right, but that's often what you hear.
Yeah, the data.
And it's not true.
That's
thank you.
All right. And here, half of Americans say that in the last year they've put off something related to attending to their own care because of the cost. So that's what we currently have. So this is a quiz because much of the vitriol comes from a poor understanding of what's actually in the Affordable Care Act. So this is a quiz that the Kaiser Family Foundation put together, and then they surveyed Americans. So if you have a piece of paper, These are true-false questions. There are 10 of them, okay? So I want you to just answer them, true-false. So here's the first one. So the Affordable Care Act will provide subsidies to low- and middle-income Americans. For that. True or false? The Affordable Care Act will prohibit insurers from denying coverage because of health status. True or false? It will provide tax credits to small businesses that offer coverage to their employees. That should be. True or false? It will require individuals to purchase health insurance if it is deemed affordable to them. It will expand the existing Medicaid program to cover low-income uninsured adults, whether or not they have kids. It will allow a government panel to make decisions about end-of-life care for people on Medicare. It will allow undocumented immigrants to receive financial help from the government to buy health insurance. It will cut benefits that were previously provided to all people on Medicare. It will create a new government-run insurance plan to be offered along with private plans. All right, let's see. And it will require all businesses, even the smallest ones, to provide health insurance, again, a typo, for their employees. All right, so let's see, how did we do? So that is true. It does provide subsidies to low- and middle-income Americans. It does, in fact, prohibit insurers from denying coverage because of health status or pre-existing health conditions. It does provide tax credits to small businesses that cover their employees. There is an individual mandate. It does expand the existing Medicaid program. Currently, Medicaid is administered by states, and so states have the right to decide how they set their threshold for eligibility for Medicaid. So in Texas, you're eligible for Medicaid if you are earning 20% of the federal poverty line.
Oh,
ridiculous. In Massachusetts, it was 200% of the federal poverty line. Wide disparity between states. And what the Affordable Care Act does is say everybody up to 133% of the federal poverty line is eligible for Medicaid, so it expands Medicaid. And as we know, the Supreme Court, this used to be mandatory for states to participate in this way, and the Supreme Court said you can't make this mandatory. So now this is voluntary for states, but it's financed by the federal government. So states don't have any good reason not to participate unless they're just being having an ideological temper tantrum. So death panels, no. Undocumented immigrants, nothing. No benefits are cut. Is there a public option? No, does not create an insurance plan. And does it require all businesses, even the smallest ones? No, you're exempt if you have less than 50 employees. So how did you guys do? Here's how the American people did. So most people don't understand it very well. And so people's feelings about it are in some ways less interesting if they don't know what they're feeling. All right. So because it's actually, I think we probably, I won't go through what I have left in terms of details. We can use this as a frame for talking about some of the other details. So. What burning questions do you have about the, oh, you know what, I actually can't do that. I have to move forward here. So there are specific details, and I actually feel remarkably well-informed about this because I've been preparing for this session. So I actually know a lot of policy wonky details about how the Affordable Care Act is doing this work. But big picture, since we need to close before too long, is that the main goal of the Affordable Care Act was to expand coverage to people who did not have coverage, right? And the way that it does that is by expanding Medicaid, as I mentioned, it actually, through the creation of these health exchange programs, which are complicated, there is to be a network that makes affordable insurance available to every American. And what does affordable mean? Affordable in the Affordable Care Act means that you should not have to pay more than 8% of your income for health insurance. The current mean among Americans is that people are spending 22% of their income on health insurance. So this is actually huge. And it creates basically a cap on premiums so that it should be possible for people to spend less money on their health care. Where does this money come from? It comes from taxes on expensive employer-based programs and from taxes on expensive Medicare options. So it's an income redistribution initiative, taking from the wealthy and making it more available to everybody who's making 400% of the federal poverty line. So that's $88,000 for a family of four. That's everybody almost within the country. When you look at the income distribution, the people who make more than $88,000 a year for a household income are relatively few. So it's actually huge what it does in terms of income redistribution to make access possible. So I think that's the gist of what I was going to say about access. But the last point here is critical. So what most people talk about when they talk about the Affordable Care Act is what I just said. How does it expand access? And is that good? Is that bad? Is that is that helpful? Is that not helpful? But the law is thick. It's much bigger than that. So that's the public debate is all about access and how we're going to expand access. But as a healthcare provider, it's this that I'm most interested in. So I want everybody to have health insurance. If health insurance is the only way we can finance healthcare, I'm not a huge fan of health insurance personally. But I mean, I would like to just not have to have a third party involved at all. I just want to be able to do what people need. But health insurance is the way we work in this country. Martin Luther, by the way, I learned in the consumer session yesterday, thought that health insurance, or insurance of any sort, was evidence of lack of faith in God. So who knows that insurance is the right way to go, but insurance is the way we go here in the United States. So I'm a fan of expanding insurance to people so that people have access. But this is actually the most interesting part of the law, which is all of these ways in which the healthcare delivery system is encouraged to evolve and change and develop to make it possible to meet people's needs more effectively now that we've actually expanded access. And so this is a list of things that came from, I'm not going to read it all, but the Journal of the American Medical Association published a piece which was, okay, for you as a provider, what does the Affordable Care Act actually mean? What are you going to be doing differently because of the Affordable Care Act? So what the Affordable Care Act does is create all sorts of incentives and encouragements and support for getting us as healthcare providers to work together more effectively to meet the needs of populations, groups of people. So it's trying to move us away from a fee-for-service model where the more I do for you, the more money I make. It's trying to move us into a system where we say the more effectively from a patient satisfaction perspective, the more effectively from a quality perspective, the more effectively you can produce good outcomes for patients, the better. And so there are all sorts of complex ways in which the Affordable Care Act tries to push the healthcare system in that direction. And my experience over the last 2 years in Massachusetts, because we're a little ahead of the national curve, because in Massachusetts, our healthcare reform, our state level healthcare reform in 2006 was sort of the template for what came at the national level 2 years
thanks
ago.
Thanks to Mitt Romney.
Yeah. Yes, thanks to Mitt Romney, absolutely.
He doesn't want to admit it.
So our healthcare system is actually much farther along And this has been my experience, that we are working in all sorts of ways that we've never been asked to work before, in partnership with community organizations, to put primary care doctors in the center of the experience that people have when they come into the system, to try to reduce waste and reduce errors. There's value-based purchasing where we're not getting paid for our mistakes, so we're super committed to making fewer mistakes. There's all sorts of healthcare delivery reform agendas that are built into this Affordable Care Act that I think most people in the healthcare delivery system absolutely welcome, because it feels like the beginning of some more sanity around what we do and why we do it. So it is noon, and I didn't have a chance. We haven't had a chance to really tie together the conversation we had in reviewing the stories of Jesus and his healing agenda, and the conversation that we're having in the country around the Affordable Care Act. But I think that we can continue that on Thursday evening when we explore this in the context of a larger forum. I want to leave with one. I'm going to close with one last story, which is the story of Jesus overturning the money changers in the temple. Because when I read the healing stories of Jesus and I listen to the debate that is our public conversation about the Affordable Care Act, this is the story that comes to mind for me. Then they came to Jerusalem, and he entered the temple and began to drive out those who were selling and those who were buying in the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves, and he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. He was teaching and saying, "Is it not written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations,' but you have made it a den of robbers?" It feels to me as though Jesus and his healing agenda, when if he walks into the temple, which is our modern healthcare debate in this country, he would overturn the tables. This is a sacred endeavor, this work of healing, this work of compassion that we are trying to embrace. And all of this conversation about who has the right and who doesn't have the right, and who should pay for it and how should we pay for it, you're missing the point. That is not the healing that I come to offer. And so it is my perspective that the Affordable Care Act moves us in the right direction towards something that's sustainable in this country. It doesn't go nearly far enough, and in many ways, the debate is missing